happen, we have to really escalate the noise we make so that we'll be heard.
Welcome to Gay USA. I'm Andy Hum.
I'm Ann Northrup, and we have a very special show for you this week at the end of the year with two in-depth conversations with some of our favorite guests. Later, we're going to talk to Mike Signorelli, longtime activist and journalist, about his prostate cancer diagnosis and treatment. He's making this public to talk to everybody about what they need to know and do. But we have our first guest right here.
Welcome, Kiara St. James. Kiara, who we've known for a long time, is the co-founder and executive director of the New York Transgender Advocacy Group. That's NYTAG.org. Originally from Beaumont, Texas, you've been a community organizer for more than two decades, now based in New York. Welcome.
Thank you so much. We're very happy and honored to have you here, Kiara. Now, it's been a hell of a year, both the best of times and the worst of times for the transgender community. Incredible, explosive visibility everywhere in often wonderful ways, but also the tragedy of the murders we hear about every week and talk about on this show. Give us your sense of where things are and what's going on and what's at the top of your mind.
Yeah, no, thank you. I really feel that, you know, we have to really get beyond being performative when we talk about this epidemic of violence that Black trans women continue to face in the United States. You know, a lot of folks may not be aware that here in New York City, within a year span from December of 2020, well until May of this year, we had 9 Black trans women murdered in New York City, right? And a lot of folks don't realize that, you know, a lot of people are shocked to hear that, you know, but we live in what is called, what we call a very progressive city, and yet we are still seeing at our, not at our back door, in our backyard, but in our front yard, in our house, right? The 5 boroughs, these are Black trans women who have been murdered in just about every borough, with the exception of Staten Island, or at least they have not, there has not been any reported cases of homicide in Staten Island. And so one of the things I think is really important to talk about is how we create sanctuaries, right? How we create sanctuaries when it comes to nonprofits, businesses, even churches getting involved in having some type of sticker or something even more visible on their front door or their billboards to let Black trans women know that those spaces are safe for them if they are feeling uncomfortable, if they feel that if they've been a victim of an assault, you know, and if they just feel uncomfortable. We need to really make sure that we're creating more tangible outcomes for the community. I think that speaks to, you know, everything looks good on paper, right? 2002, we had these rights where New York City had local protections for the TGNC community. In 2019, after 17 years of fighting an uphill battle, we finally saw gender legislated into law.
And that's the,
right? So
that's
it looked,
Gender Expression and Identity Non-Discrimination Act.
Yeah, exactly. Gender Expression and Non-Discrimination Act, that's correct. And so on paper, like, yes, all this progress is happening in New York. Yes, let's give it up, you know, for that. But at the end of the day, there's still a lot of violence that community members are still facing. And
well,
not just a...
Mm-hmm. Stay with that idea about having a sign in a store window. I've seen these in London, by the way, where they
I remember you telling me in
stores, mm-hmm. and it says, "This is a safe place for LGBTQ people. You can come mm-hmm. in here if you are being attacked or whatever." Is it happening anywhere? This could happen all over the country.
It can happen. Yeah, we definitely, one of the things we have to get in the habit of doing here in New York City is replicating, you know, our successes across the country, right? I was just in Indianapolis a few weeks back. A good friend of mine, Marissa Miller, another amazing black woman, a trans experience. She just opened up the first ever trans residency in Indianapolis. Went back a few weeks ago. For another ribbon cutting ceremony where she acquired another building. And so, you know, we see that in Indianapolis, where they have no rights for the trans community, the city of Indianapolis itself has really picked up the gauntlet and said, we will stand with black trans women to make sure that you are protected. And so New York City.
Does anybody get up this idea, by the way, of putting these signs on the windows? Is anybody doing it?
There's a lot of conversation around it. You know, definitely there's a lot of support. When I speak to elected officials, they do like the idea. It's really about getting city council involved and making it mandatory. You know, we have a, like, it's called DASA, Dignity for All Students Act. And so that was retweaked recently to make it mandatory that school officials, they report any type of bullying. So what's going to have to happen is that when we talk about creating sanctuaries, there has to be some type of, you know, like business. You know, need to also get something from it, right? Nonprofits, of course, should get involved in this, but there needs to be a way to where we have the city has incentives for businesses to get involved in protecting the lives of black trans women. And like one of the things I would love to see happen is maybe some type of employment program where these even these particular businesses that they take on one or two, you know, TGNC community members and really help them with their skill set. You know, we have a lot of amazing artists, hairstylists, you name it, jewelry makers, and there's a lot of businesses throughout the five boroughs that if we got them involved and really investing in the lives of the TGNC community in the five boroughs, I really think that's going to really impact the quality of life for everyone involved.
Well, even India, which, you know, is not the most liberal mm-hmm. place, they just established some set-asides for transgender yes. people for employment because they know how desperate the situation is. Is that on the agenda?
So definitely is on the agenda. You know, definitely one of the conversations I had yesterday was that we can't really say, oh, we're going to create set aside jobs for the trans community. Right. So there has to be a way that we talk about creating work co-ops for the community that is not seen as like any type of favoritism. So but, you know, I'm with you, Andy. One of the reasons why I founded NYTAG was I was reading about the amazing work, the groundbreaking work that they were doing in India, setting aside programs for the Hijra population to go to school, to for employment. And I'm like, why are we not doing that here in this country, right? And in this city, most of all, New York City. And so you best believe I'm going to be working really hard with a lot of other trans-led organizations as well as city elected officials to make sure that we are moving beyond being performative when it comes to how our allies stand with us.
How about making a demand that every elected official, every member of the city council, every member of the state legislature, certainly the mayor and all his departments, hire one or two black trans women in their offices? Let's just make that a demand across the board.
I'm with you on that, definitely. You know, at NYTAG, we actually have a program. It's called our Shadow Program. And within that program, we connect eight 8 TGNC community members with elected officials, usually representing their particular neighborhoods that they live in. And so for like 2 weeks, they shadow them. They learn the ins and outs of how City Hall runs. You know, they get to be in those rooms when they talk about drafting language for bills and legislations. And so we really want to continue growing that program so that we get more and more TGNC folks involved. But definitely one of the things I would love to come out of the shadow program is that a lot of these city council members, you know, they take community members under their wings after the after the 8-week program, and you know, like set them up with a job or an internship to really help establish their career in policies.
Let's talk about you a bit, because you are from Beaumont, Texas. You did start your work in Texas. You have lived in shelters. You have overcome all this. How did you do it, and how are you doing now?
Whew. So, you know, I posted a while ago, earlier this week on my Facebook page, I had to be everything you couldn't be for my survival, right? And I think that is the mantra for just about every Black woman of trans experience that I know, that this, you know, I'm doing this work not because I wanted to do it, right? But because I had no choice. There was no one really fighting for me. And I come from very strong stock in Beaumont, Texas, where we don't believe in being victims. I never wanted to see myself as a victim, you know, and so it was just something innate within me that I knew that I wanted so much more for my community as well as for myself. And so that's the reason why I started on this journey. What I'm hoping to do now is just really cultivate new leadership. You know, there's a lot of amazing younger voices who are really making inroads in the community. So I really want to cultivate, amplify, give them a platform to amplify their voices and the issues that are impacting their community that I may not be aware of because I'm of a different genre than they are.
And I've seen a lot of those younger people coming along, and they are the definition of fierce, many of them.
Yes.
But they are facing real obstacles. And one thing I want to ask you about is this horrible wave we are seeing from right-wing politicians and organizations, evangelicals, who are out to scapegoat trans kids in schools and everywhere. And the assault they are perpetrating on these kids for no good reason. And I'm wondering what you think of that and what you think should be done about that.
Yeah, you know, I do a lot of national work, and one of the things that I often tell people, we have to understand that we have no permanent allies in this fight for our collective liberation. We mainly have mutual interests, right? What we have to make sure that we are preparing our community for is that by the time the midterm election gets here, it's a good chance that we're going to lose both houses due to a lot of people's disappointment in this current administration. And so we need to make sure that we are creating bulwarks within our local cities and that we come from, so that if we have to endure another 4 years of that person, like at least we have pockets of resistance that community members from in every state can go to. So it's not about making sure New York City continues to be the bulwark of the sanctuary city for TGNC folks. We must replicate this across the country. Everybody from Beaumont, Texas, from Jackson, Mississippi, they cannot come to New York, right? And we don't want them all to come to New York because we need them in their respective states to stay there and fight for those protections that they currently do not have. Our responsibility here in New York City should be to help give them the resources to start replicating what we we've done well here in New York City.
Now, you mentioned disappointment with the current administration. Obviously, President Biden's numbers have gone down. Of course, I don't understand why they would see the Republicans as an alternative. But how have you felt about this first year of the Biden administration in terms of progress for trans people?
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand, I'm a Black woman of trans experience, right? So there's been inroads when it comes to him creating a national task force, TGNC task force. That's all fine and good. But I'm also concerned about why his administration is not pushing for the George Floyd Act, right? Why is it that there is still qualified immunity throughout this country, right? And so those are great concerns to me as well, because I could be the next Breonna Taylor. Right? Any one of us can in my community. And so we have to make sure that it's not that we're just fighting for TGNC rights. We're fighting for human rights. We're fighting to make sure that our houses are protected from law enforcement feeling that they have eminent domain to where we live. We need to make sure that we're holding law enforcement accountable, right? And so those are conversations that still need to be part of the TGNC collective voices, you know, not just about recognizing me as a woman of trans experience. I think that's great, but like also recognizing that as a Black person, I can be targeted just as much for being Black as I am for being a woman of trans experience.
Well, as Andy said, you've been doing this work for at least 20 years. My guess is much longer in one way or another. But
yeah. And I'm only 25, so I don't know how.
Very, very precocious.
Yes. Absolutely.
But there has been this explosion in the last year or two of visibility of, as you say, people of trans experience and certainly Black issues also. And I'm wondering whether it is the horror of George Floyd and related to, and Breonna Taylor and others, or the pop culture appearances of everything from, I don't know, Pose to everything else. And I'm wondering whether you think this more visible public conversation is making any difference and is having any effect.
Yeah, I would say that I'm not interested in fighting for visibility. I'm not. I'm interested in fighting for protections. I'm interested in fighting for equity, right? Being visible does, you know, is, you know, I think my community has always been visible. But of course, you know, because of the internet and how people focus on such a very small demographic, because the community I come from is very small, but it weighs very heavily on the minds of so many people for good and bad reasons, right? I think the main concern for me is making sure that we are creating economic opportunities, right? We're creating radical programming. If people who have been living their lives and doing amazing things, but yet they don't have a degree, how can we help them get lived experience credits that can be transfer into a degree to make them more competitive? Those are things I'm really interested in. I think that we hype up visibility too much, and it's not really about being visible for me. It's really about making sure that we have protections for everyone and we have people being able to have access to health care and housing. That's where the fight for me has always been.
So how should people help if you're a run-of-the-mill person who hears this or is aware of the issues and wants to help in concrete ways on issues like employment and housing and health care? How specifically should people help?
Yeah, definitely. You know, reach out, you know, you can reach out to me and my staff, NYTAC.org, you know, is our website. You can donate. You can, like my telephone number is pretty accessible to everyone. You can get in contact with me via email, Kiara@NYTAC.org, Kiara at NITAC.org. But also make sure that, okay, I'm getting ready. But also making sure that you are reaching out to your elected officials and asking and demanding that, that they do more as well.
Now, one of your more famous quotes is you said the first act of resilience is to take a breath and acknowledge that we have a right to exist. Very basic, but what, you know, where did that where does that come from and what does it mean to you?
Yeah, so what it means to, for me is we must not forget our humanity. Too often coming from the community that I do, we're too often fighting, being angry. And I really want us to take a moment to reflect upon who we are as human beings and understanding that we have a right to have a full human experience that is not connected to violence, that is not connected to being seen as less than. And so it really comes just of reminding my community that they are worthy of all the abundance that life can afford them.
And well, speaking of the right to exist, I mean, you had a great success this year in the New York State Legislature. Put up that picture. Repealing the Walking While Trans law. When you know the other picture, Rich. Yeah, you were on the cover of City and State New York as the Pride Power 100, and that's what you were fighting for, and you were successful. So that's about being able to exist, being able to walk the streets.
That's right.
No, without getting arrested for essentially for you know they just pick off. We're picking off trans women, especially trans women of color, and saying you're a sex worker no matter what you were doing.
That's correct. And even, you know, I really want to also just say this, that I believe that everyone who engages in sex work has a right to be protected and respected. But what we do not want to happen is that when people see black trans women, that's the first thing they think is that we're all sex workers. I come from sex work. You know, sex work, I made a comfortable living from it for quite some time. But I do want my community to understand that and people who target my community to understand this is really about making sure that we're creating other possibilities. And that can only come when we minimize the trauma that is inflicted upon my community.
And you've also said that there's a lot of problems in shelters and in hospitals for people of trans experience. How is that being turned around? Is there education going on? You have the policies which say you can't discriminate, but they are.
Yeah, I have quite a few staff members who they do work with graduating nurses. We're actually doing one with Mount Sinai for next year, scheduled some 400 graduate nurses. And so it's an ongoing process because, as I said, you know, things look good on paper, but what we don't take into account is that there is implicit bias in the people who are becoming nurses, right, and doctors. And so we really have to make sure that these trainings are not once a year or every 6 months, but, you know, because of the turnover rate, that we're doing it on a regular basis.
Well, Kiara, you are an admirable figure in the work you're doing. We very much appreciate it. And Cranes New York, a business publication, called you one of the most powerful women in New York. I fervently hope for that because I want you to have that power to affect the change that you want and that needs to be made.
No, yeah, thank you. It was a great honor for me. You know, the work still continues. I definitely will be pushing for $1 million fundraiser for my organization to really start working on a brick and mortar space in Mount Vernon so that we can really start having a headquarters, a physical headquarters that is specific to working on behalf of the community in a much more impactful way. And so next year, like, I'm claiming bigger and greater things for NITAC and, you know, in the community that we serve. So, but it's an honor to be acknowledged.
Well, keep us posted on all the developments and how we can help and how we can spread the word.
And people can look at your website, NYTAG.org, NYTAG.org, and be in touch to help.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Kiara. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Happy Kwanzaa.
We'll try.
Happy Kwanzaa.
Well,
What the issues Kiara is dealing with are so overwhelming and daunting, and I am so in awe of her and all her colleagues for taking this on. And I hope that all of us can pitch in whatever ways, large or small, we can to help out.
As Ann Northrup says, everybody just needs to do something.
And as Andy Hum says, we're all in this together.
We are, I hope.
Yes. So we want to now bring you our second interview of this special year-end show with our old friend, Mike Signorelli.
And we are joined by Michelangelo Signorelli. You may know him as a longtime activist, the author of Queer in America back in 1993. It's Not Over, 2015. ACT UP, Queer Nation. But of course, currently and for a long time, is the host of the Michelangelo Signorelli Show, Monday through Friday, 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Sirius XM Progress 127. He's a co-founding editor of Outweek back in 1989, a member of the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association Hall of Fame. And we welcome you, Mike.
Thank you for having me. Great to see you both.
But we certainly are here to talk about the issues of the day and about LGBTQ stuff. But we're here to talk about prostate cancer today. Mm-hmm. You put an article on the Signorelli Report talking about your experience with it. Why don't you take us through your journey?
Yeah, it's one of those things I think is so important for people to learn about and focus on, because, you know, with all cancer, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind, and people don't want to think about it. And this in particular is one in which early detection, it's 98% curable. It's just about that detection. And for me, I had no symptoms of prostate cancer. I had no indications of it. I'm very active and healthy. I have no other problems of any kind, luckily. And so it really was about regular PSA testing. And my doctor, in my routine physical, it's a blood test, did a PSA test, and it came back slightly elevated. And, you know, that can happen from a lot of different things with a PSA test. It's the prostate antigen that is put into your bloodstream, and prostate specific antigen. It could be from bike riding. It could be from working out a lot. It could be from sex. I mean, anything can make it rise. So it's not a huge concern when it slightly rises. It's when it keeps rising that it's a concern. And so we waited about 6 months, and I went to a urologist in that time, and it went up further. But there still was no indication through a physical exam, no sonogram showed anything. So then, you know, your choices are a biopsy, or if your insurance will pay for it first, an MRI. But my insurance company wouldn't pay for it, which is another beauty of American insurance. So I went for the biopsy in the office. It really wasn't that bad. I know a lot of people have said this biopsy is painful. And I don't know whether it's about the doctor's technique, but for me, it was really simple and easy. And
can you explain that technique that they use to do a biopsy? A friend of mine had it. They put 12 needles right under his scrotum, you know, into his prostate. Is that what happened with you?
Well, there are two different ways to do it. And what you're describing is a transperineal biopsy, or then you can get a transrectal, which is right through the rectum. You're talking about one that's just below through the skin. So I got a transrectal one. That could be why different people talk about different amounts of pain. I took some Valium and he put some local anesthesia and I just felt little pinching, you know, and I counted up the 12 needle, the 12 cores they take out. They take out what they call cores, right, of samples of the biopsy. And then my doctor called me a couple of weeks later and said, you know, there was cancer. So, you know, that was that moment where your heart sinks.
And the prostate's a very small organ. You know, it's about the size of a walnut, or in my case, probably an apple by this point. I mean, it gets enlarged as you get older, right, generally, and it constricts urinary flow and all those kinds of things. And those are the kinds of problems that I have. But, you know, you started this article on the Cindy Rilley Report saying that you're going to be fine. And then you go into it. You have cancer, but you are not being operated on. You are not being given a procedure other than active surveillance. So explain how you can have cancer, which you have to worry is going to spread, but what active surveillance involves.
And I'm glad you said that because when I wrote about this on my newsletter, when I did an hour on my show, I did a Twitter thread, I did it on Facebook, I made sure to start out with, I've been diagnosed with prostate cancer and I'm going to be fine. And I think it's very important to point that out because, again, early detection, you can treat it. Now, this has been for a number of years now, maybe the past 5 to 10 years, active surveillance is actually a treatment. And that is monitoring with PSA tests and monitoring with further biopsies. There are some people who, if it's very low risk cancer and it's not fast growing, and most prostate cancer is not fast growing, will never really develop a threatening, form of cancer and will die of something else. It will grow inside of them for 20 or 30 years. It just depends on what they call the Gleason score, what they find in the biopsy. And so I was in that sort of lower intermediate range where just like people with low risk, lower intermediate can pursue active surveillance, which is just watching and seeing what happens. Subsequently, I went to a number of doctors and I went to Sloan Kettering here in New York City, which is one of the best cancer hospitals in the world. And I've had some more talks about actually starting treatment because unlike people who are in that lowest of the risk, I'm in the lower intermediate. And this is one of those things where suddenly you're considered young at 60. And the belief is that I will probably need treatment at some point. It could be 10 years. It could be 15 years. And then why do that then? Why want to go through that then? And who knows what else I might be doing and whatever. So I'm now looking at different treatments. And the great thing about early detection and the great thing about being in this position is it's like a shopping spree. You know, you go and look around and there are so many different treatments. And I've decided to pursue a radiation treatment. There are so many different, even among radiation, different ways, different kinds of radiation that will expose you to less radiation. I'm lucky that this is so early that I can choose something that exposes me to the least amount of radiation. And they've come really far where the side effects are really, really minimal. And that's something else a lot of people were, I think, always very afraid of in terms of getting tested for any cancer. They're afraid of what are the side effects. You know, even for people who have even a little bit more advanced prostate cancer now, you know, they used to have like 9 weeks of radiation. And this is true in general now with cancer. That's now been reduced down to 5 sessions of 3 minutes each of external radiation. 5 sessions, 3 minutes each, because they can now, through lasers and other strategies, get the high dose radiation to just the organ they're dealing with instead of exposing all the other organs, and even doing that, having to do low dose. So that's one option. The other option that I think a lot of people have heard about is the radioactive seeds, which they can also just put a minimal amount right inside your prostate. And those, over a period of months, the radiation kills the cancer.
I think John Kerry did that when he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, did the seeding business. So let me understand. Now, you went to a urologist. I go to a urologist. I'm just going for an enlarged prostate. Did you have any problems with your urination and all those things? Or is this unrelated?
No. Yeah. That happens with prostate cancer usually later. That's why people really need to get the PSA test. Some people have enlarged prostate and also have prostate cancer. And I've since connected with so many people, and going public was so important for not just others, to help make sure people think about testing, and you know, everybody listening. There are different recommendations from different groups, but the American Prostate Foundation says go at the age of 40 if you're Black, and then, you know, if it's in the family, there's a history, or 45 if older than that. The Prostate Cancer Foundation, I should say. American Cancer Society has a different age group. U.S., you know, Preventative Task Force has a different age group. So you have to make the decision for yourself. But to your point, the my prostate is very small. It's not enlarged. So it wouldn't cause those symptoms. And it is one reason why I can pursue some other treatments that are even better, because the smaller your prostate, the more options you have in terms of treatment.
And you know, you mentioned the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. They say start at 55, but they also say, wait a minute, they say, but you don't need to do it after 69. And I've heard this, like, well, because if you get it by that point, you talked about it as a slow-moving cancer, it's not going to kill you. Is this...
Well, it might be the case that your doctor will say, when you're 70 or 75, you have a slow growing cancer and you don't need to do much about it. And we don't even need to test anymore. Nothing's going to happen. That might be the case, but the U.S. Preventative Service, the U.S. Preventative Task Force, the problem that they sort of created, and that really has been created over the years, is this fear of overtreatment and fear of overdiagnosis that has caused their recommendation to change over the last 20 years, like 3 or 4 times. So they initially, in the 90s, had everyone who has a prostate testing all the time. Just get a test in your blood test. And they found that that led to too many biopsies because, as we've discussed, your prostate, your PSA can go up for a lot of different reasons. Of course, if the insurance companies would pay for the MRI, that would make it so that we didn't have so many biopsies, right? But anyway, there were too many biopsies. And, you know, a biopsy is obviously an invasive procedure. And also, it's the mental anguish of waiting for that biopsy. So in 2011, they went in the other extreme completely and said, we're not recommending anybody get a PSA test at all. Just talk to your doctor if you get symptoms. Well, that caused such an outrage. You know, it just caused all kinds of chaos. And what that led to was later, in the next few years, higher reports of advanced prostate cancer, because now people weren't getting early detection. So in 2018, they changed it to what you just described. Wait until you're 55 and then talk to your doctor. Don't even start, but talk to your doctor about starting and whether it's right for you. And then stop at 69. So, as I said, the Prostate Cancer Foundation says 40 if you're Black. And this is the other thing. There's not a lot of distinction. People of color, Black people, and even Latino people have a higher rate. Anyone who has prostate cancer in their family. So I've now connected with people who are in their 40s who have prostate cancer and early 50s for sure, quite a bit. And I just think, what if they had listened to that recommendation of wait until you're 55?
So are there any differences for gay men and for trans women who have prostates, of course?
Well, there's really so much now that talks about the challenges that are faced by gay men and trans women when it comes to treatment and when it comes to just dealing with this in society and in culture that wasn't out there before. And certainly there are so many support groups and online you could connect with people. But the medical field has generally always focused, when they've talked about sexual function, on heterosexual cisgender men. So even when they have questionnaires that they would have people fill out and they talk about intercourse and they'd say, you know, when you have intercourse, are you able to penetrate? Well, what if you're not doing that, right? So the medical field really had been a mess. And I think activists had worked to change that a lot. And it's still, depending on what hospital you go to or what doctor you see, you'll still get that. I've luckily just been, you know, able to, well, not luckily, I think because I made sure I went to gay doctors and I then went to the doctors they recommended. And being gay has been very much incorporated into how I should treat this. And certainly when it comes to sexual health, there are different challenges that they need to talk about with you and that you need to tell them about and be able to tell them about in terms of what's important to you. Because otherwise they're thinking you're a heterosexual man who may or may not be having sex with his wife.
And of course, the prostate is an organ of sexual pleasure.
That's right.
Which, if you know, rub is feels pretty nice.
And to that point, there are, and we should point out, there are a lot of, especially urologists, because they are surgeons. There are a lot of surgeons who will say, just take it out. And you know, there's surgery. People can have the prostate. Say doing radiation, and that's an option for people, and people can make that decision. A lot of urologists will just say that and not think about, for some people, the importance of trying to keep the function of the prostate there. So it is something for people to think about before they rush into surgery.
And for those who've been listening carefully to this discussion, we should just say the PSA is a blood test, so that's easy to do. The actives, and of course the biopsy, we know what that is with the needles, but the active surveillance involves what? Just tracking the PSA or also further biopsy tests?
It incorporates both, and it depends on how long you're on active surveillance. PSA tests regularly, beginning maybe every 3 or 4 months, and then they see how fast it rises or doesn't rise. And if it really doesn't arise, they'll maybe say PSA test every year. They may say another biopsy in a year. They may say another biopsy in 2 years. It really just depends on what they're seeing in terms of your particular cancer. And I don't want to get too technical about Gleason scores and all of this kind of thing, but there are certainly grades of cancer where they might just say, come back in 2 years for a PSA test, or come back, you know, you don't need to get a biopsy at all again, because this is just not growing fast enough and you're going to die of something else at some point way down the road.
Is there a particular website besides of course, your own, and people should read your article, and we'll include a link to it in our email, that you recommend where people go for information?
Well, all of the, I've read everything, so all of the major medical centers have really, and certainly cancer centers like Sloan Kettering, like NYU, Mount Sinai, Johns Hopkins, UCLA, all of these major medical centers have enormous amount of information. But I would say the Prostate Cancer Foundation's website is very important for people to go to.
Okay.
And in terms of reaching out and just getting that experience on the ground from people, there's an incredible site called Health Unlocked, which I don't know if you've heard of. Where people are connecting to talk about everything that they're dealing with, no matter what it is. And there are groups for every kind of condition, illness, ailment.
So Health Unlocked. Is that it?
Health Unlocked.
Well, Health Unlocked. Okay.
Health Unlocked. And it's been great to connect with people. And there's even a group in there for prostate cancer and gay men, right? There's all different groups. And so what people will often do, which is so important, is they'll do the treatment journal. Like I've decided on this treatment and here's day one. And then the next day they post day two. And it demystifies all of it. And you can also then connect with people and ask them questions. Why did you decide this treatment? Why did you decide that treatment? They also talk about doctors, and and there are a lot of patient advocates on there, and it's a way of keeping the doctor. You know, you should get the best doctors, and then you should question the doctors, and then you should know how to question them, and then you should talk to people who criticize the doctors. So it's about managing your health and staying in control of it.
And I really appreciate the hopeful and calm nature of this discussion and the fact that you're routinizing the idea of diagnosis and treatment. But I just want to remind people, we report every week on this program about various people who've died, and a number of them are people who have died early of prostate cancer, and it is something to be taken seriously. And just because we're having a very useful and hopeful discussion about how to proceed to investigate this doesn't mean people should just ignore it. It is important to get diagnosed, to get tested, and to find out where you stand.
Yes, and to that point, and so important, just a few weeks ago, James Michael Tyler, who was Gunther on Friends, he died of prostate cancer at the age of 59. He had a more advanced cancer for sure, but he didn't start PSA testing until 2018 when he was 56. And that was his first test. And his wife had been urging him for years before that, and he just hadn't gone and gotten it done. And we're just talking about a simple blood test. And he then said, he's put out videos and whatnot before he died and other urgings that he should have gone earlier because it had gone out of the prostate to his bones. And once that happens, it's a very difficult diagnosis.
Do you think some
while it's localized in the prostate and treated then?
Do you think some non-gay men, worry about it because the doctor might stick his finger in your rectum, which is part of the test where they feel around how the prostate
very
feels?
Important. Very important to bring that up. And I wrote in my article and talked about on my show, and it's great on my program to have so many people call in who've been through it and also dealt with homophobic doctors. You need a PSA test, but you also need a digital rectal exam, which takes like 20 seconds with the doctor putting his finger up your butt. Because sometimes the PSA test will determine something and the digital rectal exam won't, and sometimes it's the opposite. The digital rectal exam, something is felt and the PSA test doesn't show it. In fact, some advanced cancers, there's even a lower PSA test. So it's very important. And I will tell you that just from speaking to doctors, including my own doctors, about this, many doctors do not do a digital rectal exam. They just won't. And they don't do PSA tests either because of this controversy over the PSA test. So they don't do either. So you are completely in the dark.
I had a doctor I dropped because stuck the finger in, took it out in 2 seconds. I said, "What are you doing?" "No, no, you're fine." You know, it's like he didn't feel around to see. And then a gay urologist put it in, felt around. There's a little hardness here. You're going to have an MRI. And that confirmed that it was okay.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, and even when you watch or read some of these doctors or watch some of their videos, the way they talk about it, they'll say, you know, I know you guys don't want to get a digital rectal exam, and I know it's really difficult. Believe me, it's hard for us too, but it's got to be done. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Women have had... have to deal with for many years male doctors putting their hands all over them to treat them, and sometimes inappropriately, right? And did what they had to do because it's about their health. And here's like a doctor trying to get a man to get a digital rectal exam and saying, I this is as bad as for me as it is for you. I mean, come on.
Well, thank you for all of this, Mike. We could go on and on probably for the full hour. In fact, we wanted to ask you a lot of questions about the issues of the day. And I think, Anne, we're going to have them back.
We can do that again.
I think so. Just tell me whether you agree that the world is coming to an end.
Well,
maybe. Maybe.
I'm going to say if we do not act very quickly.
Well, let's quote Michelangelo Signorelli this morning on Twitter. "We are totally screwed, and Democrats have not seemed to realize this or aren't able to deal with it."
All right. To be continued.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for devoting time to this. Very important. Thank you.
Extremely. Thank you. We'll see you soon.
Well, that was quite a workout. And it's a very important issue. I mean, right after we taped that interview, the New York Times did a whole piece on gay people and prostate cancer and all the special issues for gay men. And of course, as we noted, this is also an issue for trans women who still have their prostates.
You know, I had a conversation with someone after we did that interview, saying to them, repeating what Mike had talked about with doctors' discomfort about doing digital exams. And this person said to me, no, that's impossible. Doctors couldn't be reluctant to do that. I said, I'm sorry, but they are.
But, and of course, at the very end, we were, of course, Mike does the, you know, progressive radio over there at Sirius Radio. The whole larger issue. What a year this has been. I mean, we got rid of Trump, or not entirely, but we got a whole new administration, a whole new Congress, and yet we're still very, very fearful, and we're not overcoming the slide into fascism in this country.
Well, we certainly aren't, and that is absolutely terrifying. And we're letting ourselves get caught up. I agree with the people who say we're spending too much time getting caught up in these internecine battles within the Democratic Party. I think at some point we have to acknowledge that there are limits to what Joe Manchin will sign on to. I don't want to give him control over the world, but we've got to sit down with him and say, look, we must reach a deal of some sort. We can't continue to delay all this. We've got to move ahead. And so I'm less concerned about the actual details than I am about getting something done.
I mean, it is very tough to get things done under our system of government, which is, and I don't like to end on all these negative, dire notes. I mean, look, I'm 68 years old. We grew up in a society where hardly anybody could come out, basically, and that's changed. There's lots of great things that have changed. People have to take the power that they have and to use it. The same thing goes with the women's movement and the fact that it looks like we're going to lose a blanket abortion rights, which is horrible. But look at look a couple of weeks ago, California said, we'll be a sanctuary. We'll help you get it. Come here. We'll pay for it, etc. Those kinds of things.
Well, I also haven't given up on these elections, either the midterm elections or 2024, because we have proved in both the 2018 midterms and the 2020 presidential election that if we get enough people out to vote, we can win.
Neither has Sean Patrick Maloney, the Congress member from upstate New York, who heads the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. You give him these hard questions. We'd like to have him on the show here. I've listened to him elsewhere, and he keeps trying.
Sean, all is forgiven. Come to USA.
I know we had a rough start, but yeah, we want to hear what the plan is.
We do, but mostly what we want is ambition. And an aggressive attitude in working for this stuff. And sometimes I think that politicians have just, certainly Democratic politicians, have just given up. And I'm really tired of people blaming the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and saying that they're ruining everything. That's utter nonsense. And people really just have to get more aggressive about putting out their platforms and their issues and their values and really fighting to win these contests.
We also have to be much more interested, and this is going to sound, I don't want to say crass, holding power. That's the number one objective of the Republican Party, is holding power. They don't necessarily want to do anything with it other than destroy things. But
well, and make rich people richer.
Yes, of course. Well, exactly. So we have to be focused on that, because without that, you can't do anything.
Yeah, but I think it's all possible. And I think people just have to get active. And inertia is our biggest enemy, because the small minority of right-wing crazies steps into that breach. Well, they are taking power in spite of the fact that their points of view are literally a small minority in this country.
And, we've been at this for more than four decades, activism and things like that. And we have trouble overcoming inertia sometimes. But we come back here to do this show every week.
We have nothing better to do.
Oh, no. Look, we really appreciate our viewers who tell us. I mean, these end-of-the-year notes, I don't even know, I hardly know any of you personally, and yet you write these notes that make us feel so good about what we do here, and we so much appreciate it, and we thank you.
Completely. And I joke about this, but I talk about inertia because I do recognize the impulse to inertia. I think that's very natural and something we all feel, but that is why I say you don't have to personally change the world. You just have to each do a little bit. Each of you doing your part is keeping us on the air, whether it is your kind words or your financial support or whatever. It all adds up to us hanging in here.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here every week, and that people are actually part of this discussion. You give it back to us when we need it, and you give us information and news, and we appreciate all that.
And on that note, in our last 10 seconds of this year, we just want to say thank you.
Happy New Year!
We'll see you next year.
Bye-bye.